I really wanted to write a book that was not all about money and spreadsheets and optimizing. I wanted it to be a book that was about your life and thinking about the life that you want to live, and then putting money behind that of like, okay, and then how are we going to build a financial system that gets you to that life? Mm-hmm. And that takes on some of the stuff of like, early retirement's not some magical thing. It's not going to make your life perfect. It's not going to make your marriage or partnership or relationships perfect. You're still going to have to work at that stuff, but like, let's deal with all the challenges that can come so that you can anticipate them. So I really think of it as very much like a life first kind of book, money second. And I think that to me is the thing I want people to know most of all.
Welcome to Michelle is Money Hungry. I'm your host, Michelle Jackson, sharing shows on personal finance, online entrepreneurship, and creating your best life for financially single women. Today's episode is sponsored by the Money on the Mountain Retreat, a financial retreat for financially single women. Go to michelleismoneyhungry.com/retreat to pick up your ticket or to find out more about the event. Please note there are only 100 tickets available, so once they're gone, they are gone. Today, I am so excited to share this guest with you. She is very aware of the importance of her presence in the space that she's in. She's in the FIRE movement, Financial Independence, Retire Early. She's releasing a book. She runs an incredible podcast as well as a blog that many people are reading, especially in the FIRE space. Make sure you like and subscribe to the show. Without further ado, we will begin the conversation with Tanya Hester from Our Next Life. Enjoy. Hey, 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 everybody. How are you doing out there in the big bad world? I may have been watching way too much Sons of Anarchy and X-Files, so I'm very weirdly channeling strange energy right now, but that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter, because today, for those of you who want to just kick your job to the curb, be millionaires and live your best lives, and you're like, how do I even get started on that? My guest today is going to school us on all the things that she did. She and her husband, because they are in an equal partnership. Oh my God, I'm not going to sound like that. I grew up in Boulder. Don't judge me.
No judgment. I'm laughing with you. A support laugh.
I'm loving this intro, and yes, I will be keeping it. So today, I am thrilled to interview Tanya Hester from Our Next Life, the blog. She is also an author, and she's currently in the process of marketing that book, sharing all the things. I just got mine today, the day that we're recording this show. So there's so much I want to get into. I'm getting really excited. So Tanya, before I lose my mind, hi girl, how's it going?
Hey. I'm super stoked to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm just glad that I was able. I was like, this woman is busy. I don't know how we're going to do this, but I'm going to ask. So thank you for taking time out of your schedule to speak with me, speak with the listeners, and kind of share your story. So if you could, for those people who are like, who the hell is this lady? What is going on? Share a little bit about yourself and why you think I am interviewing you.
Oh gosh, why are you interviewing me? I can't answer that, but I will answer the rest of your question, which is, hi, I'm Tanya. I retired about a year ago at the age of 38. I'm now 39, along with my husband, Mark, who was 41, now 42. That's how math works. And we were both political consultants for obviously fairly short careers, but they still felt long because those are really intense, high stress, high pressure, long hours, lots of travel kind of jobs. And so we, about 6 years before we pulled the plug, we just kind of decided like, oh, we need to do something else. And we didn't know at the time what that was going to be. We certainly didn't know right at the outset that it was going to be early retirement and that we were going to be able to quit our jobs and never need to be employed again. But we just knew, like, this is taking a huge toll on us. This is taking a toll on our relationship. This is stopping us from doing the things that are really important to us in life. And we got to figure out something else. And so we really just started by saving more, figuring that that would give us options. But we did not dream at the beginning of that journey that we would be able to walk away from work in 6 years. So when we got there, I definitely was at a point where I was like, you know, I think there's such a, I'm just going to say it, like, there's a lie out there in a lot of the kind of financial media community about having to be super frugal or having to be like incredibly amazing at money. And we weren't bad at money at that point, but we certainly weren't great at money. We were definitely not great at saving. We were really good at spending. And
that's the American way.
Of course. And that's like what we're all told is what we should aspire to. We were doing it real, real well. So I just wanted to give an example of people who were not super frugal, who did this through some pretty reasonable steps, and also to show people that it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It doesn't have to be just early retirement or nothing. You can semi-retire. You can do what I call entrepreneurship for wimps, which is go to work for yourself, but give yourself a really huge safety cushion or safety net first so that you don't have to feel the same stress that others have to who have to be successful right out of the gate. Or you could do something like a career intermission where you quit your job for a year and go travel or do whatever you want to do, whatever is on your life list. So to me, I hope that's why I'm here to talk about that, which is all what's really in the book Work Optional, which I'm just so excited to get out into the world. I'm so glad it's finally in your hands, Michelle, and Yay. In more people's hands soon.
For those of you who are still like, wait, you're telling me there's this lady who's 40, who's 39 and her hubby is 42 and they're retired. What do you mean retired? So listeners, I have done a couple of quick episodes about what is called the FIRE movement. There's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of pushback about it. There's a lot of energy behind the acronym, positive and negative. And for the regular person who's making 50 grand a year, maybe even, you know, combined with their spouse, the idea that they could potentially retire early may trigger some emotion, some kind of like negative emotion, like that's not possible for me. So I kind of would like to talk about the emotion that's not possible for me, but also just earning more. So you were in, I actually didn't really think about the fact that you could earn a nice wage doing what you were doing, but it totally makes sense. You were king makers and queen makers, quite honestly. As political operatives.
Can I jump in real quick? One thing I do think is important to specify, because like I always want to be perfectly transparent that we were each earning six figures. So like that we did this on 30K each. But the thing that I do think is significant is like those careers that we had, they make you pay your dues in a big way. So like we both started at 30K in Washington, D.C., which is an expensive place to live. And so it was only in those last several years that we were earning at that level. It wasn't, you hear students graduating from, you know, tech programs with computer science degrees, getting six figures right out of college or within 3 years. Like that was nuts.
You know what? You don't share that enough, I think, actually. You don't share that when you got out of school, you guys were making 30 grand each. That's a very interesting story for me because then I'm like, well, how did you grow your income? Because at the heart of FIRE, in my view, I just don't think you can out frugal your way into a FIRE life. You know what I mean? Like you can't out frugal a regular American lifestyle and hit FIRE. Like it's all about earning more and decision. So you've got me really thinking about, I didn't expect myself to go down this road because I didn't know about it. Let's talk about how you grew your income.
I do want to address your earlier question about the emotion of it, because I think that's real. Like, I do think that sometimes when people talk about early retirement or FIRE, they sort of act like, oh, anyone can do this. I think that's crazy. Like you said, if you're in a couple who are earning 50K combined, I don't think that early retirement is probably feasible at that level. That's not to say you couldn't find ways to grow your income or change your career path or do a number of things to put yourself in a different financial situation. But I'm not interested in lying to anybody or making people feel like failures because they can't save half their income. I think instead, what I really wanted to do is make it more inclusive. And that's why it was so important to me to talk about semi-retirement or, mm-hmm. you know, if you work 40, 50 hours a week, which we know from research that the vast majority of salaried employees are working 50 hours a week or more. If you could get to a point where you could work 30 hours a week, or you could work 4 days a week or 3 days a week, you're still working, but you have suddenly so much more time back. And that's something that I think is more realistic for more people. And so a big focus in the book is about that too. But back to your question about growing your income. I mean, yeah, like I think that to me is definitely has been the key for us. And that's why I mentioned the lower income part, that you don't have to start out in a super high earning place to be able to get to good earnings. And a lot of that for us was very much about, we actually stayed in the same jobs for our whole career.
What?
And yeah, I know. So Mark was with his company for 20 years. I was with mine for 16. And I had one job before that one for a little while. He had no jobs. That was his only job after college.
Wow.
And technically, you know, usually that's not actually a great way to grow your salary.
It's very unusual, actually. I
totally
grew mine that way, but I was in education. So I worked my previous job for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, keep going.
Yeah. So like, I do think you can get a lot of bang for your buck changing jobs, because that's, of course, when you have more negotiation power and you can bump your salary up. So I don't want to discourage anyone from that. But in our case, I do think that the loyalty paid off, and we were able to demonstrate that loyalty, demonstrate our increasing capacity to add value for our clients and our employers. And, you know, to us, it was very much about leaning in. I actually don't like that term at all, and I'm not the hugest Sheryl Sandberg fan.
I haven't read the book yet.
I mean, it's basically like how to succeed at work and life for very privileged women.
Okay. Well, that, you know, I'm good. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, Sheryl. But there's such a tendency, if you realize that early retirement is possible, or that being able to scale back on work is possible, to suddenly go like, oh, well, why do I even need to be here? Or why should I try my hardest if I know I'm not going to do this until I'm 65? And I think my recommendation is really, don't do that. Like, don't disengage. Engage more. Because in a way, if you know that this chapter of your life is going to be shorter than you originally thought, why not dedicate yourself to it totally? It's like, you know, all the different stages of life, like college, for those who went to college, I hope you tried your best, because you knew that that was going to be a stage of life you didn't want to throw away. Or I think other things like relationships you have, even if you don't know where a relationship is headed, you still invest yourself in it. So I think investing yourself at work both gives more personal satisfaction, but also really, really can lead to a lot more income if you show that commitment and have quality work to match over a sustained period.
How did you grow your actual positions? You're in the same job, but you clearly grew your expertise. And I think that that's the piece also that people kind of forget that they have control over. So I, with all of this stuff that I've done online, when I was at my old job, like I started blogging, I started doing podcasts, I started speaking, I started doing a lot of things that my job wouldn't let me do within mm-hmm. the context of my career. And so for people who are like, you know, there are things I want to do and I want to grow my expertise, where should I begin? So I'm curious to see how you did that within the same organization and grew your income.
A bit of backstory for folks. We both work for companies that have, I would say, a non-rigid, non-hierarchical structure in terms of what you're allowed to take on, but a more rigid structure in terms of levels. So we both definitely climbed the level ladder. We both started as assistant, and I ended as a senior vice president. Mark ended as a partner, which is a level up from that. And so it was definitely a number of promotions over the years that got us to those points. But I think the biggest thing was always being willing to take on more and volunteering for things. And so, yeah, sometimes it meant that I had to work longer hours than I might otherwise have had to, but I both could demonstrate that I was growing skills. I demonstrated willingness and a team, you know, orientation, which I think every employer values. Mm-hmm. And it was enjoyable. Like, I loved learning new stuff. I would never want to do a job where I was doing the same thing all the time and wasn't getting to grow. So it wasn't like it was some deliberate, calculated move of, okay, if I say I'll volunteer for this, then I'll get this promotion. It was more just like interesting. Like, I want to make the job interesting. And also, I think I'm capable of learning how to do that. Also, a funny side effect that I think is worth mentioning is I taught yoga as a side hustle for 10 years.
You did?
Yeah. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, because I mean, like, all my career was in DC and then LA. And then even when we moved to Tahoe, Tahoe is still super expensive for people who don't know. I mean, it's like any kind of resort town. It's just crazy expensive. And so especially early in my career, like when I had student debt and I had credit card debt, like I needed to make more money than I was making at work. And yoga was great. And then I eventually taught spinning also, which was even better because then I got a workout. I got paid to work out. It was the best. But all of that taught me to get comfortable speaking in front of people and speaking in the moment, being able to observe what's happening and still know what the focus is going to be. And that was a skill that turned out to be crazy helpful in my job, which was not at all why I started that side hustle. I just needed money and loved yoga, but it ultimately was something that I was able to bring into the career and help advance the career in a big way. Because once they realized that I was a good speaker and could present well, I think that that was a huge part of me being on a faster career track. So I just think like thinking that way about how a side hustle or how another project like blogging or, you know, whatever it is that you're into, how that might be able to benefit your career in some unexpected ways. I think a lot of people would be surprised.
It's so awesome that you mentioned this because I often joke that my brand ambassador side gigs were the best training for becoming an entrepreneur because you have to pitch the entire shift. You're literally giving people something for free and you're trying to compel them to take it. Mm-hmm. You'd be shocked at how many people are like, get out of my face. And I live in a, and I should say, I live in a really friendly, happy place. So most people are like, okay. But, but for a lot of people, the rejection part of that is very, very intense to experience. Mm-hmm. And because of my years of being a brand ambassador, one, I earned more money and I was able to pay off debt. But two, I was able to kind of grow some cojones. You know what I mean? Like I am ballsier about asking for things because I don't get affected by the no anymore. Not really. Because I'm used to pitching for a shift hours and hours and being like, no, that's okay. Yes, I would love that. No, that's okay. And, you know what I mean? And like sharing the talking points of that item that I'm trying to get them to like so that they'll buy it later. So you guys, don't sleep on those side hustles. I'm really super excited that you were a yogi, that you are a yogi. Were you doing like vinyasa or ashtanga? What were you doing?
Yeah, it was vinyasa for sure. I definitely love flow, but I mean, it will not surprise you knowing my blog a little bit, and for those who might know it, I was not all about the rigid Ashtanga stuff. Like, this is not a competition, people. We are not trying to like count how many sun salutations we can do. This is just about being present and breathing and moving your body and feeling good about that. So, I loved that stage of my life. I actually don't do all that much yoga now, and I don't totally love the yoga industrial complex that has developed, but it was such a great time and it gave me so many different benefits that I never could have imagined. So yeah, I agree with you. And I think your example is perfect too, in a big way. Like those side hustles can just do so much for you that you would never imagine.
You know what? The next time you come to Colorado, you're going to have to do yoga with me. There's a certain teacher who teaches a yoga, she has a yoga business now called Big Booty Yoga. And all of her yoga basically is incorporated with current like music, a lot of hip hop, sometimes Beatles. So like sometimes some classes are called Namaste because it's with Beyonce music. She did one with Prince. So it's like all Prince music. So the next time you're in Denver, we're going to go to Big Booty Yoga. Or yoga on the rocks at Red Rocks. But anyway, listeners, I digress. We're going to get deep into it. So I want to know how you ended up, you guys kind of have this vague idea, you set this goal and you start working toward, like, how did you even know about the math? Like you're smart people, but there are millions of smart people who don't sit down and go, you know, I'm kind of over this and yeah, what's the exit? So how did you make the logistical and intuitive mathematical leap from the feeling of this isn't working to this is the money that we need to have?
It definitely happened in stages. And I think the biggest transformation for me was less about figuring out the early retirement math, which I really do think is simpler than most people probably imagine. And it really stems from just knowing what your lifestyle costs. And once you know that, the math is actually pretty easy. But I think for me, the biggest transformation was going from being a person who spent every dime I made and then some to becoming a person who could actually save money. That was really, really hard for me because there are just, I mean, I don't know if you pick this up hearing me talk, but like, I love so many different things. I love going to restaurants, tasting new foods. I love travel. I love, you know, I'm not huge into stuff, but there are some categories where I can spend a lot of money. Like, let's talk about my stationery and pen problem.
Oh my God, don't get me started. Journal. I love journals. So I've gotten kind of shady because when I go to conferences, I'm like, okay, how many can I have? Because then that way I don't buy them.
Oh yeah. Whereas I'm like super particular. And so I'm like, I don't want that free crap because that's like not going to be that good. I need like this. I need like my Japanese paper. No.
Oh my God. You're that girl. You're so that girl.
Totally. I know. I fully confess. So I'm saying that just to share with listeners who are like, yeah, yeah. You say you were a spender, but I don't believe you. I'm like, no, listen. So I think that a lot of us who enjoy spending money or spend money, whether we enjoy it or not, feel like, okay, it's going to be impossible to save these big numbers. And I stumbled upon a solution that for me was life-changing, and it was totally by accident. So a couple of years into my career, when I was still in debt, I was still, you know, I had bought a car with 100% financing, brand new. Wow. It was an economical car, but like that was a bad financial move. Let's all be honest about that. And so I was not in a great financial place. I would set goals of trying to save each month and I would fail. And I just was honestly like in a bad place in terms of how I saw myself because I was like, you know, I think lots of people look at me and think I'm doing well in my career, but like I can't even function on a basic financial level. And what happened was my company switched to a new payroll system. So we all had to fill out new paperwork. And on the form, it had two rows. So it had what's your primary account, and then it gave you a chance to put in a secondary account. And that kind of blew my mind. And I was like, huh, what if I put like $50 a pay period into that second account? Like what would happen? And so I started doing just that little tiny amount, $50 a pay period into savings, which, you know, not a huge amount of money, but it was more than I'd ever saved before. And a few months later, I was like, oh my God, I have a couple $100 in the bank. And that for me was a big deal.
No, that's a big deal for a lot. I mean, like 80% of Americans are paycheck to paycheck.
Totally.
So there is no shade on this. Like that's a big deal. It's a transition.
It was. And it was such an aha moment for me of, holy crap, I can use this. Like that money is in a separate account. I don't see it in checking. So I don't feel like I have it to spend. Like I can work with this system. And so honestly, that was the system that I carried all the way through to early retirement. So at first I just started notching it up. So it was like, okay, can I get to 75 a pay period? Can I get to 100 a pay period? When I would get a raise, I would raise that amount a little more. And I mean, at the time I wasn't even investing. That money was just going into savings, but I was actually seeing myself able to save. And it, I mean, like it sounds silly to say, but it changed my whole view of myself. And then Mark and I got together around that same time, and we were living in Los Angeles where it was incredibly expensive to buy any sort of property. It was pre-crash, so the prices were insane. And we were both looking at this like, okay, we're both like smart people. We went to college, we have good jobs, and yet like we can't even buy like a piece of crap condo. And we kind of decided then like, let's save for that. So, I mean, actually first I focused on paying off my debt, which I did when I was 27. And then we focused on saving to buy a place. And we used that same technique of hiding all that money from ourselves, kind of siphoning it off the top of our paychecks so we never saw it, didn't feel like we had it to spend. And that let us save so that we could eventually, right after the crash, buy a condo in LA. And then once we had that, we just kind of like used that momentum and we're like, okay, well, we shouldn't, like we got used to living at this level. So let's not act like we suddenly now have all this extra money. Let's keep saving it. And so that was really, I promise this is all reconnecting to your question of like, how did we get there to early retirement and figure all this out? I mean, it really came out of that earlier money journey and then taking those steps and just funneling them into a new, much bigger goal. In terms of actually figuring out the numbers, I have to give credit to Robert and Robin Charlton, who wrote a self-published ebook. You know, it's nothing fancy, but it was super helpful to us, called How to Retire Early. It's on Amazon. And that just, they were so awesome. They saved for early retirement in about 10 years. They retired in their mid 40s and they did not have fancy jobs. Like they were under six figures combined for most of that time, but they shared every number. They shared how much they made every year, how much they saved, all the investment earnings that they made, and they showed you the whole thing. And seeing that laid out like that, I was like, oh, we could do this. We earn more than that. There's no reason why we can't do the same thing. And so when we first started thinking about it, we were calling it our 10-year plan. And then it just so happened that we got there a whole lot faster and we're able to finish the 10-year plan in 6 years. But as you know, I think probably clear from this, but we didn't start from zero when we started the plan. We had home equity. We had some savings. Mark had been a rock star at his 401k from an early age, which I will forever be grateful to him for because I was not. So that wasn't starting from scratch at all, but it still, I think, shows the power of what you can accomplish when you're really motivated and you know what your vision is. And it's not just like numbers on a spreadsheet. It's really like a life vision because we knew what we wanted our life to be. And it was not the life we were living at that time. So we just had tons of motivation to make it happen.
I like that you shared that example. I've never heard of them before. Can't wait to check out their book. I love your story though, because maybe no, Mark didn't start where you did, but there's still two of you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you still had to do certain things. He still had to do certain things. You had to manage mindset. And I know lots of people who are high income earners and they're broke. Mm-hmm. Like it's not an uncommon thing at all. I do not know the following person, but is a good example, Johnny Depp. So there have been all these stories about Johnny Depp, right? And how he had, you know, he earned about $650 million. And they're speculating that he is now bankrupt. He's just about to, you know, get to that point. So my point is, it doesn't matter how much you think, how much you make, it's like what you make your money do.
Yeah.
It's a crazy example, but that's why I used it.
Oh, and I would love to spend $650 million. But I can't even imagine that.
I can't imagine even, I don't even have the energy. Like all I want to do is go hiking and hit like travel and sit in the hot tub or like, you know, do artsy things and take my mom to stuff and date a really hot guy. Like I want to keep it simple. Spending $650 million is a lot of work for me. And I've killed my shopping habit. So I would get a maid though. I can't lie about that. I would totally get a maid, but I'm like freaked out by big places. So I don't even want to live in a big place. So I've taken some steps subconsciously that have killed my ability to consume like that once I'm a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
And I'm glad.
It's so good because I think that what you said is so right on. And for folks who are interested in this, another book that I really recommend is The Millionaire Next Door by Thomas Stanley. And
great actually book.
His daughter, Sarah Stanley Fellaw, just released a new edition of it, The Next Millionaire Next Door. And I haven't actually read it yet. It's sitting right here on my desk on the to read list. But in that book, he talks so much about these ideas of wealth that we carry around and that the people who are truly wealthy are rarely the ones you would think. And in fact, physicians and lawyers in particular are almost all broke. Like they're generally terrible savers. They live lifestyles that they feel like they have to project a certain image. If you're a surgeon who drives a 20-year-old Honda, everyone will think you're a bad surgeon. Mm. And if you don't join the country club, you don't do all these extravagant things, then that somehow is a reflection on your skill. And so I think that was another book for me that was really transformative of like, oh crap, I see. Like the people who accumulate wealth are the ones who are not spending it. And so yeah, to your point, like anyone can be broke at any income. It's obviously easier to save the more you earn, but oh, yeah. But yeah, let's not assume that like people who earn a ton are necessarily financially virtuous or good with their money.
No. And then there's another example of that lovely man. I'll have to figure out what his name is. He's a African-American guy out east in Virginia, I think in Virginia. And he was a parking attendant making about $15 an hour. And he's a millionaire.
Wow.
And the reason why is he invested and he was working as a parking attendant at a bank. So the bankers would talk about different things with him and he would take their advice.
Wow.
So the other piece to this conversation is your money does what you let it do. you know, what you tell it to do. And just because you have smaller amounts of money, small amounts of money add up to big amount of money. That's my point. And that's something that as I've paid down debt, you know, with small amounts of money, sometimes larger amounts of money, and I am transitioning into FIRE, hopefully by about July of this year, you know, I have to remind myself that one penny plus one penny equals two pennies and so on and so forth. Like the effort is worthwhile. And as I make different choices, I'll be able to grow my efforts. And I think that that's something that sometimes when I hear FIRE people speak, they talk about it, but I think that it's hard when you're at the end of your journey to reflect on what used to be. You know what I mean? Like when I'm rich, I'm going to be honest, when I'm rich, I don't want to really reflect on how hard it was before.
I think there is some big truth to that.
I just don't. I want to move on. So that's why it's important to do interviews like this before you're like, you know what? I got to go to Zanzibar. And I remember the yoga side hustle, but I've got to take my retreat in Zanzibar. I don't have time to talk about this. So we're going to shift a little bit in this interview. This is going very differently than I initially planned, and I'm loving it. Like I'm really geeking out.
Oh, great.
I'm loving it. So I want to kind of touch on briefly how you guys ended up even blogging about this. Like, why did that become a thing? Because blogging is a lot of work. So you're like, we're going to quit and we're going to live our lives, but you know what? We're going to start blogging. So what the hell? Like, how did that happen? What's going on? You were blogging anonymously and then you stopped being anonymous. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about that whole journey and how you were able to inspire other people with the information that you shared.
I suspect you did not do this intentionally, but you actually just asked an incredible segue question.
Oh.
Because it was my motivation for starting the blog, Our Next Life, was exactly to your point of I wanted to remember what those stages of the journey felt like. Mm-hmm. You know, by the time we started saving for early retirement and when I started the blog 4 years ago, we were already a little bit down the road. We were earning at a very comfortable level. We were saving a lot. You know, we were making fast progress. And I knew that by the time we got to the end of that, that I was going to forget like the ups and downs. Because I think people probably imagine that when you're earning a decent living in a job or even a very good living that, you know, you don't have stress or that stuff about money doesn't freak you out. And I think that's so untrue. You know, like the journey to early retirement was full of emotional ups and downs along the way. And, you know, especially when you have like a pretty massive sum invested and it's in the stock markets and those things are roller coastering constantly, like just that can be stressful. And learning to cope with that stress, I think, is an important part of the process. But I just wanted a record of it. I just wanted to be able to look back and be like, oh, hey, what was that like? What was it like in the last 3 years of saving and, you know, getting into the home stretch? And was the last year different from the third to last year? And I did not intend at all that it was going to become a thing. I didn't expect anybody to read it. I didn't think that I was going to have, you know, all these comments I was going to have to respond to. That was totally the wrong way to say it because it is such a privilege. I am always thrilled when people leave comments and it feels like having a conversation.
My mom doesn't even read my blog. Okay. So like it's funny because you get these comments and stuff, but you don't know if it's going to take off. So I guess your answer tells me that you had no idea it would resonate in the way that it did.
Oh, not at all. I was not trying to like get blog famous or any of that stuff or make money off it, which I think is a common misconception. But no, I've made actually $0 on the blog. I'm way in the hole if you count all my expenses. I've made now a little bit of money on the book, but that is the extent of it. I mean, it was just a very expensive hobby to do the blog. But was sort of around in the space and was engaging with other blogs and was on Twitter, which is where a lot of the financial bloggers hang out.
They sure do.
Yeah. I really felt like, oh, there's all this stuff that's not being talked about. Like no one's talking about identity and the fact that you might lose your identity when you leave work and might need to find a new one. And that might actually suck. Like that might be hard. Mm-hmm. Like let's talk about that. Or like, let's talk about the fact that for me, a big part of my motivation to retire early is the fact that I have a genetic disability that my dad also has. And I have always known that that was very likely to come. It's looking like I'm going to have a less severe version than he does, which I feel so fortunate for, but I don't know that. That's not certain. And so that was part of why I was like, okay, clock's ticking. Like, if we're going to do this and have a different life, like, we got to hurry up. Right. And so I wanted to share that. And I felt like at the time, no one was really having that kind of conversation or, you know, just like talking about the emotional side of it. And so I started jumping in and trying to like fill those gaps that I saw. And I think that did connect with people because I think that's when the blog started to actually like get shared and saw new people showing up. And I still get such a thrill thinking about those days, but that was certainly not the game plan from the beginning.
You could certainly monetize your site now, given the traction that you have, to be candid.
Yep.
Why do you choose not to? Because at this point, it's obviously a choice.
Oh yeah. No, I know that I could, and I think I could actually do decently well. I think for me, it's several things. One is just knowing myself and knowing that as soon as something becomes a job, that it sucks all the joy out of it. And so I don't want to suck the joy out of my precious blog baby. The other thing is just reader experience. I really care a lot about that. I've always had an ad-free blog. I don't want to gum it up at this point. And then I think the other thing is really just reader trust. Like, I do think that I've built a reputation as someone who will tell the truth, who will talk about the dark side of early retirement, who will talk about the stuff that isn't all like puppy dogs and rainbows. And I feel like if I start throwing a lot of corporate stuff in there, I would erode that trust. Mm-hmm. And I fully recognize that that is an incredibly privileged place to come from, of like, I can dump hours and hours and hours of my time and not make money on it. And that's okay. I know that not everyone can say that. And so I feel really, really lucky to get to do that. But to me, it just feels like a gift to myself and the readers not to monetize. And so no plans to change. I will say on the podcast, we take ads and I have zero problem with that.
Podcasts take a lot of work. So
oh, yeah.
Your coins, because that's a lot of work.
And they have more built-in costs that I think people don't realize. Like, you can do a blog for very cheap. If you do things like have a big email list or do Photoshop or things like that, that stuff adds up. But podcasting is expensive even when you're itty bitty.
I would definitely agree. I would love to talk about being a woman and a well-known woman in the FIRE community. What is that like? I'm going to keep it that broad, actually. I want to see what you have to say. So what is it like to be a woman in this space?
There's so much in that question.
Such a loaded freaking question.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I laugh to myself a little bit at the question because I think that I'm well known among certain folks. I also think there are plenty of folks who have no idea that there are women blogging about early retirement and still only know kind of the bigger male written blogs. But I think when I did get lucky in that I was one of the first women in the space. There was definitely Paula Pant and Liz Thames, who is Mrs. Frugal Woods, were in the space before I was, but they each had kind of a different focus. You know, Paula's thing isn't totally early retirement, and neither is Liz's. She's much more like frugality and homesteading and that stuff. So I think I was one of the first who was like pure FIRE woman. And so part of it was just luck that I was there early. And there are so many more women in the space now, which is amazing. But I do think it makes it a little harder to stand out. And the second thing is, like, I just think back of all the times I've been asked to be on a panel or something like that. And
you're their token. Come on.
It's oh, like, I know. That's
it's
what
like
I was
my life. Okay. Like,
yeah, Tanya, I'm the token chick.
You're walking in my shoes.
I mean, I'm a white woman, so like, I don't.
But still,
I don't have. You have double token points.
I know, right? You guys, don't get all up in your feelings, Jesus.
We're saying this in a joking way because yeah. Like, it just happened, you know, like yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah. And so I know that there have been times where I've been asked because I am a woman and can talk about technical stuff, but you know, like I've really just tried to use that as a way to talk about some of the things that people aren't talking about, or to invite other women or people of color into the conversation, and tried to use that platform for good as much as I can. But no, I mean, it's FIRE has long been a boys' club. And I think a lot of that was just the tone that was set by Mr. Money Mustache, who was the first FIRE blogger who really like got big. But all of the guys who were in the space early were men. And so mostly white men. And so I think that that is just sort of like the perception. There's this perception, which I think is untrue, that it's just white men in tech who are the ones who can do early retirement and it's not for anyone else. And I do think that was a big motivation to me to write the book, Work Optional, because I was like, no, let's show lots more people how you can do this and show how you can be in performing arts or be a teacher or be any number of things and still give yourself financial flexibility.
I want to really talk about financial flexibility and with a key focus on flexibility, because it's my view that the American employer actually has how they view employing people completely wrong. A lot of people would probably not be attracted to FIRE if they had more work-life balance and flexibility. I lived in Europe. The way that we work here is not sustainable. It's crazy. I'm just going to be blunt about it. It is not sustainable. We don't have enough time for ourselves. We don't have enough time for our families. We don't have enough time for our kids. And whether you like it or not, how other countries do what they do, I will say having access to more time is the key part of building a happier life. Since I left my old job and I've had time, wow. I can't even explain how I haven't been sick. I literally have not been sick since the end of 2014. I haven't had a cold. I have not been sick. It has not been easy because I've been focused on entrepreneurship and online entrepreneurship. So that's, I should say, it's been challenging in that respect in terms of money, mm-hmm. but I've paid off thousands of dollars of debt. I've lowered my overall overhead. I'm living a great lifestyle. But I was working in education. So this, to give you perspective, I was working in education. I had 5 weeks paid vacation, okay, every year because I accumulated it. And that was not, I was like, you know what? I can't work like this. Like the commute, the stress, there was just a lot of stress. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where I think a lot of the interest in FIRE and just leaving is the lack of flexibility. I used to look at bears during lunch hour because bears come down to where it's Colorado. Mm-hmm. Or like I'd go hiking for a couple hours. Towards the end, I was kind of over it. So I would just hike. I was salaried. So what could they do? So I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to go hiking. And I would go for like 2 hours and come back, you know, or go to. So when I say that I left a job like that because I needed more time, that tells you something.
Yeah. I mean, and the research bears this same point out, that we are just working at chronic burnout pace. And corporate profits have been going up since the 70s, but you see a split then of productivity continuing to increase, but earnings not going with it.
Exactly.
And it's been great for investors. And as an investor, I have benefited from that. I don't feel great about that. I would love to benefit from true productivity that also results in workers getting paid better. But yeah, I mean, that is the culture. And I agree with you. I don't think there's anything wrong with work. When younger people come and ask me questions of like, oh, I hate having to work. I want to FIRE. I'm like,
no. Okay. Like, work is great.
Work is great, and work can give you purpose. And also, like, we are just wired to work. But so my problem is not with work. It's with our work culture.
Exactly.
And yeah, if you can give yourself the ability to have time to hike or whatever it is, like, it changes your life so much.
I'm still laughing about that because last time the bears came down, that was adorable, but it's obviously highly dangerous to look at bears up in the tree. But I digress yet again, but that's okay. That, you know what, listeners, that's a glimpse into my life, and it's real. These things happen. Mm-hmm. I am very curious about why you then, after deciding to be a blogger, you're like, hey, let's do a podcast. What the hell? So you start a podcast, which is, you know, kind of work intensive, and you have a fabulous co-host, Cara Perez from Bravely. What was the onus for that? Like, why? Why would you do this to yourself?
It's funny. The story of the podcast origin is it was not like some long, deliberate decision. She and I were in a mastermind group together, and she kept talking about how she's broke, but in a way that felt like she was describing not a temporary state, but her character or, you know, herself in a deep way. And every time I heard her say that, I felt like a pang of wanting to go like, no, that's just now. That's like a point in time thing, not your identity. And it bothered me as her friend to hear her calling herself broke over and over, because I just felt like every time she said it, it was becoming truer. You know what I mean? Right. And I was like, I understand, because I was at a point, I mean, for plenty of years in my early 20s when I was broke, but I feel so fortunate that I didn't take that on as a long-term identity, and so was able to get out of it. And I said to her, like, hey, I mean, first of all, Kara has a beautiful voice. She is such an amazing talker, has such great thoughts. So it started as actually me approaching her and saying, would you be game to do a podcast where we talk about being at different points in our financial journey and kind of have conversations about that and have people come and talk about like where they were? Because like we were kind of talking about earlier, like I think people assume because I retired early that like I always earned a lot of money or I've always had my financial act together. It's like HGTV, like you only focus on the after, but the before matters too. And I wanted to hear the before. And so I just have always kind of seen Kara as like so similar to me in so many ways, but like kind of at the before point. Although at this point she like paid off huge debt. Like she's amazing. She's totally not at before. She is midway in the journey, but that's where it started. And then the more that we talked about it, the more we just would always end up on these like feminist rants. Realize like, oh, this is what we actually need to talk about, because I think there's so much in personal finance that understandably tends to be about what advice can I give you as an individual to go change your life? Because each of us can only change our own lives. You know, we can't go change the world every day or, you know, change every single thing we need. Like that stuff's slower, but we can change stuff in our own lives more quickly. But we just felt like no one was talking in a big way with, you know, a huge variety of guests about like the big problems that really do stand in people's way. And, you know, we're seeing so many like personal finance bootstrap stories of like, look what I did and nobody helped me. I did it all myself. And we're just like, oh my God, like, can we talk about all of this stuff? And so that was really the origin of the Fairer Sense. And yeah, I mean, we're still at it. We just launched season 3. I mean, I love it so much. And we've just been able to have really interesting conversations with people, because I think folks are used to coming on podcasts or whatever and like talking about their personal story. But people aren't used to getting to kind of rant against the system. And I think that sort of.
I just remember her going down with patriarchy.
Oh yeah. No, that's fully our mission. We're trying to kill the financial patriarchy, which does not mean men. It just means the system that prioritizes men over women. I always feel the need to clarify that. But yeah, it's so much fun, but also it feels important, and I feel really proud of the work that we're doing. And so, yeah, it's definitely something we're going to keep going with.
Very briefly, what do you think is the deal with the lack of empathy for other people when people are telling their freaking bootstrap stories? I'm so over it. Like I've gotten, you know, I've been in this space for a long time, and the longer I'm in this space, the more those kinds of stories really piss me off, or that kind of mindset, because I see how hard it's been for me to change my own habits and mindset, mindset being the key. And I think that people just, I don't understand what it is, but it enrages me actually. Mm-hmm. When they're like, well, I don't understand why they did that. I'm like, they probably did it because of something they're feeling. Like maybe they don't know something. So could you very briefly touch on just empathy in the personal finance space?
Yeah. I mean, I will say all the same stuff that enrages you enrages me. I do a couple things. One is actually, I wrote a post, this is the only post I will plug, but it's probably my favorite post I've ever written, called Of Boosts and Bootstraps, where I basically, spoiler, tell my story one way, like the bootstraps way of like, look at all the stuff I did for myself. And then I tell the same story through the lens of like, look at all the people who helped me and all the advantages I have.
Oh, wow.
I wrote that post really to kind of like counter that bootstraps thing. And so I've shared that, like, I think I wrote that almost 3 years ago, but I share it pretty constantly because the topic comes up over and over. The other thing I do is when I see other people lacking empathy, I feel like it's not right of me to come at them without empathy for them. Mm. So I try to come to them with empathy, even if they're not showing it, but, you know, model the behavior you want to see, right? Be the change. And so I'll tend to say things like, oh yeah, like I used to wonder that too. And then I read this great book, or, you know, I was totally in that place, because it's true. I don't think that I've always been a super empathetic person. I think that I used to sort of look at a lot of folks and go like, oh, why are you making bad choices? So for me, it's been a real learning journey. And I just try to like help spur people on that. So like some of the books that I like to recommend are Nickel and Dimed by Barbara Ehrenreich. Oh,
great book.
Yeah. It's a little dated at this point, but like it still really holds up. For people who seem interested in poverty, I love recommending Linda Tirado's book, Hand to Mouth, that sort of explains like why people living in, you know, real like deep poverty make some of the choices that they do. And then another book that is, I recommend, I don't love the author, Matt Taibbi. He seems like kind of a jerk, but he wrote this book called The Divide that I forget exactly what the subtitle is, but it's like American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap or something like that, where he looks at stories of like how the criminal justice system treats rich people. Like for example, the people who sank our economy in 2008 and how it treats poor people. Like for example, folks who are just trying to get by and need a little help. And shows you all the ways in which we are so much harder on welfare recipients than we are on obvious white collar criminals. And those three books together, I think are like, I recommend those kind of left and right. And I have actually found some people come back and go like, okay, yeah, like that was really eye opening. Thank you. Wow. I don't expect everyone to do that, but like, I'm not going to stop trying.
We're just about done with our conversation. Cause I almost feel like one day we're going to have to go somewhere really cool, like to one of your Sense Positive retreats. And yeah. I'm segueing. So first of all, I want to say publicly, thank you, thank you, thank you for creating this incredible space. It was a blessing for me to participate this past November. I was actually dealing with, last year was not my year. I'm going to say it that way. And it was just a hard, like I was just having a hard time, you know, at various points of the year, and being able to participate in the retreat, having a scholarship available, you had scholarships available so people could attend, honestly was so wonderful for me. I don't want to get like emotional. I'm just saying I really appreciated it. And I would love for you to share why you created Sense Positive, what the mission behind it is. Hopefully you could drop some info like where it's going to be. And then, share the details.
Yeah. And thank you for saying that, Michelle, that means a lot. I'm glad to know that it was so impactful for you, because
I loved it.
Yeah, good. Thank you. That just like fills my heart up. For me, I realized that women were craving a space. I didn't feel like it had to be me, but I saw, oh, I'm retired now. I have time. I can be the one, you know, I've got time, so I'm going to do this. But I saw so many conversations online where women would be talking about something really heartfelt and, you know, a guy would come in and hijack the conversation, or just, and even very well-meaning men would, I think, just assume that male content is gender neutral. And women's content is too feminine, or, you know, like is gendered, male, ungendered, female, gendered. Mm-hmm. And think that, okay, well, we should be getting all our needs met through these gender neutral conversations. And I felt like, you know what, that's just not true. Like all the stuff that I talk about with women when we're one-on-one, when we're at FinCon or other events, there's just all this other stuff that comes up. You know, women have different feelings of guilt sometimes for earning too much, or, you know, what feels like too much of like, wow, all these other people have so little, why should I get all of this? I've never talked to a guy who said anything.
I've
like
never
that.
Heard a dude say anything about that. Are you kidding?
And so like being in a all women space where we can say like, yes, that's normal, but also stop that. Like you're working hard, you deserve that money. And also like, you're going to do good things with it that are going to help lots of people. Like that's not a conversation that felt like it could happen in a mixed gender space. And so, I felt that need in the community and was just sort of like, okay, why not me? I'll make it happen. And that first event was, I think, just like so amazing. I had so much fun, even though I was kind of running around doing organizer stuff, but just seeing everybody else having these great conversations, it felt really special. And in 2019, right now the plan, none of this is totally locked down, so I can't commit to anything, but the plan is to have two of them and to do one that's more kind of rustic and lower budget. And that is most likely going to be in the Pacific Northwest.
Ooh.
And then to do one that's for folks who want a little bit more comfort, that will be in the Midwest. So stay tuned for details.
Can we get like vague months?
Oh, that is the challenge. Trying to get the best deals. Cause I do not ever want to have an event where the cost of the event sets you back from achieving the thing you're going to the event to achieve.
Exactly.
Like trying to get the best deals, like just, you kind of have to be flexible on timing, but I would say late summer and fall is most likely.
Okay. And then finally, let's talk a little bit more about Work Optional as we wrap up our conversation. If you could share just the genesis of the book. Oh, random thought. When did you decide to create Sense Positive? Was it sometime in July? You're like, you know what? I feel like doing this. Or what was the genesis of Sense Positive from the time you decided to create it or it became an idea in your head to fruition?
I think it was in my own, this is very typical of me to take on too much, but it was definitely in the middle of writing the book, which is exactly the wrong time to take on something new, but oh well.
I say nothing.
Yeah, exactly. I think, I'm not remembering exactly, but I think that the idea, and when I said, okay, let's do this, was around April. And
wow.
Then I believe we opened registration in June and then filled up in 2 weeks. And then we did scholarships in August. And then, yeah, the event was the very start of November.
Wow.
So it was, I mean, I did a lot of events for my old career and you were there. So, you know, this was not a massive production event. We had one conference room in one hotel.
I really liked how you did it.
Cool. Thank you.
And you actually, because of your event, it gave me the final go ahead to create the event that I've created. It's not a fire event, by the way, people, but impressed upon me the need to create spaces.
Mm-hmm. I think though, so important, especially for taboo subjects like money. I think having spaces just to come and feel safe and to be able to have the conversations you need to have, I think there's huge value in that.
Okay, so you've got this book that you wrote, which is not small. I'm looking at it. It's like a big book. And how does it feel, first of all, to be Tanya Hester, author?
I still I have one copy of the finished book on my desk and I've handled it like every day and I just pick it up and I'm like, oh my God, like that's really my name.
Oh,
it's
my
really
God.
On there. It's printed. I remember the first layout version I saw where I was like, this is my Word document. And now it looks like a book. It is still super surreal just to see it and like to see people start to post pictures of like early reading copies of the book. I'm like, oh my God, like it's out in the world. People are reading it. It is really cool, but also kind of nuts.
What would you like us to leave with from this book? So we read the book. What is the experience you want us to have from it? What do you want to inspire?
I think that I don't believe that I copied Oprah, but I think there's a lot of like an Oprah vibe. Like in publishing, they always like to say, this book is so-and-so meets so-and-so. Like I think that the way that I would pitch it, even though it's not this, is like Oprah meets Tim Ferriss.
Except
without being like a teaching people to be sleazy like Tim kind of does. I really wanted to write a whole book that was not all about money and spreadsheets and optimizing. I wanted it to be a book that was about your life and thinking about the life that you want to live and then putting money behind that of like, okay, and then how are we going to build a financial system that gets you to that life? Mm-hmm. And that takes on some of the stuff of like early retirement's not some magical thing. It's not going to make your life perfect. It's not going to make your marriage or partnership or relationships perfect. You're still going to have to work at that stuff, but like, let's deal with all the challenges that can come so that you can anticipate them. So I really think of it as very much like a life first kind of book, money second. And I think that to me is the thing I want people to know most of all. But to me, like wrapping money in the life idea makes money so much more accessible and so much less scary.
What is your life like now? Was retirement or has retirement been what you thought it would be?
Yes and no. I've had some health challenges this year that have made me sit indoors a lot more than I like. You know, like you, I love to be out hiking and skiing and doing everything. Mm-hmm. I did a bit less of that in my first year than I expected. But yeah, I mean, my biggest thing is like, I just always want to have the ability to say yes to things. And I think Sense Positive is a great example of that, or like the book is a great example of that, of like, this wasn't the book that I had in my heart that I knew I had to write before I died. I wanted to write books and this was the opportunity I had, but being able to go like, yeah, I want to write that book was such an amazing gift. Or being able to put on Sense Positive was such a privilege and a gift to me too, that like that wouldn't have happened if I was busy with work. It was having time or knowing like, yeah, I can rearrange stuff and make that happen. So what it looks like, I mean, I think I do still spend a fair amount of time at a computer, that looks probably a lot like work. And I know folks who like to tell you whether you're retired or not would call me not retired because of that. But like, I don't need to make another penny and I get to spend every day how I want. And if I'm working, it's because I want to be working on something and it's like a passion project and not something for someone else. And so I don't know, I feel like I'm living the dream. I feel like the luckiest person, and it's just a beautiful thing. And I would love for more people to get even, you know, a little bit of that. Even if you just free up like one day a week or you get to take a year off, those are amazing things. And you can feel that stuff too.
What's the deal with the retirement explainers? I don't get that. Like, why are people telling me what my retirement is? Who the hell are you to tell me what my retirement is?
It's such a funny argument. And it's something that
it's
no
so
one
weird.
Who is retired would make. It's one of those things of like, you just like, you don't even get this because waking up, there's just something in financial flexibility and then later financial independence of knowing that you don't need to make money from anyone else ever again. You just wake up with this sense of like power every day. And that to me is what this is about. It's like that power in your own life to do what feels important to you. And if it looks like work, that doesn't make me not retired. Like, the retirement is the power, not the how I spend my time. And so yeah, I think people who try to enforce that stuff, like, they just so fundamentally do not get it.
I'm like, have you talked to someone's grandparent who's retired? They're the busiest people I've ever met.
Yes, they are.
Like, oh my God, my grandma is, age will not be disclosed, grandma, even though you don't listen to my show. Thank you. She is on committees. She goes on shopping trips to where my aunt lives in another city. She's in the Midwest, so they kind of go around. She has a mink coat that is in a special storage that she gets delivered every winter so that she can have her mink, it's floor length, by the way, jacket and hat. She's like living the dream. She bought a new car last year or the year before. You know, she is busy. She goes to exercise class. I'm like, retirement definers have not talked to people who are retired. Like, yeah, the traditional way. She's on committees. And I literally said to her, I was like, Grandma, how did you have time for work? You're the busiest person I've ever met.
Yeah. Part of it that makes me crazy is like, traditional retirement is not people's image of it.
No.
A third of people, 65 to 75, still work. Most of them because our system is so broken and they don't have adequate retirement savings and Social Security is not enough to live on. But a lot of them, it's also like a passion project or they just don't want to give up work entirely. So maybe they work part-time. But like, we are all familiar with the Walmart greeters. Like, those folks are all over 65 and no one would go up to them and say like, you're not really retired. It's like such a silly, silly argument.
All right. So how will we find you? we're like going to go off. So how are we going to find you and buy your book, even though technically I will be including a link to your book in the show notes?
Yeah. The book is called Work Optional, Retire Early, The Non-Penny Pinching Way, available everywhere you buy books as of February 12th, although you can pre-order online now. And please pre-order through Michelle's link, of course. And you can also find me on my blog, ournextlife.com. The podcast is called The Fairer Sense, C-E-N-T-S. And that is our URL as well. Or you can look us up on iTunes or all the podcast places. So yeah, I'm in a few places. You can find me there. I'm also on social.
How can we sign up for Sense Positive? Like, how can we get in the loop, stay in the loop for that?
Yeah, it's sensepositive, sensepositive.com. You can go, there is a totally non-annoying, non-in-your-face email sign-up form. So it's not spammy. I don't send regular newsletters. I only email folks when there's news. But if you want to stay up on that, you can get on that list. There's also a Twitter. If you're a Twitterer, it's @sensepositive. So nice and easy to figure out. But yeah, for sure, I'll share all the updates on timing and places there.
And I get that email and I can vouch that it's totally not spammy.
Thank you.
I just want to say thank you so much for spending time with me today, virtually talking about all the things. The conversation went totally left, which actually I'm very excited about. I am thrilled with how our conversation went. Like, you shared all the things I had no idea about. And I hope that the listeners enjoy this conversation as much as I have. It's been wonderful speaking with you, and I'm just so proud to see all of the things that you're doing, and just am inspired and excited to see how your next year and how you enjoy your next life as it continues to unfold. And if you ever do a yoga retreat in Zanzibar, I'm your girl.
Deal. I so appreciate you saying all of that. I'm sitting here like floating up above my chair hearing you say those things. But it has been an absolute blast to talk to you.